Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We speak with Dr. Joel Covell. He's had a distinguished academic career at Albert Einstein Medical School and Bard College. Bard still lists Dr. Covell as Distinguished Professor of Social Studies in the Human Rights Program of the Political Science Department, but he says his contract was terminated over his political values about Zionism. Professor Covell tells his story online at joelcovell.org. We interviewed him as part of our longer special coverage coming up in March on the perils of reporting and engaging in open debate about Israel. First, we hear from Jim Loeb, Washington Bureau Chief at the international news agency Interpress Service. He joins us with an overview of President Barack Obama's appointments on the Middle East. Jim Loeb, welcome.
It's a pleasure.
You have long been covering the neoconservatives, and I think people turn to you for sort of taking the temperature of U.S. policy. I want to ask you now about U.S. policy toward the Middle East under Barack Obama. Just in general, do you feel encouraged, discouraged? Where do you stand on what's been developing over the last couple of months?
I weigh slightly on the encouraged side. I think his appointment of George Mitchell was quite encouraging. The fact that Dennis Ross appears not to have gotten the influence that I believe he was hoping for. Some of the rhetoric by Obama, I think, has been quite helpful, and I think we're seeing the beginnings of a kind of dance between Iran and the U.S. now that will lead to negotiations. Of course, the situation with the Israeli elections is not particularly encouraging for anyone who wanted to see some progress on the peace front and possible momentum to the kind of Annapolis process, for what that was worth, or for Mitchell's efforts. But at the same time, I think a lot of things are going on in the region that the United States has not objected to, at the very least, that could wind up with a new unity government for the Palestinian Authority, and also for new unity within the Arab League, a kind of reconciliation between Saudi Arabia and Syria in particular, which, if they get their act together, could result in a new summit, will result in a summit next month, but out of that summit could come a reiteration of the 2002 Arab peace plan, which would then put the onus on whatever government emerges in Israel, and would permit the United States or Obama, if he so desires, to actually put some pressure on Israel to respond in a more positive way than it has in the past.
I would say the Jerusalem Post has covered a story that I never expected to see. Evidently, Israeli officials are worried that the Obama administration might actually try to use military aid to Israel as a way of pressuring the new government. And they say into dismantling outposts and freezing construction in settlements. Evidently, Defense Minister Ehud Barak, with the outgoing Olmert administration, of course, has already held consultations on this. What do you make of that potential for pressure with using military aid at this point?
Well, I haven't read the article, but the United States has used military aid, or more specifically, deliveries of military aid in the past as a source of pressure on Israel. Even the Reagan administration did that to some limited extent. And also, of course, as was reported by David Sanger, the New York Times, who's no dove, last year, the Israelis asked for certain kinds of weapons as well as permission to fly over Iraq for an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities that they may or may not have been actually serious about, and the United States, according to Sanger, said no. I think it's possible that pressure could come in that form, although I don't think it would get much support in Congress, which ultimately controls the purse strings. But I think pressure can come in other ways, in much more direct ways. I think statements by the United States of disapproval of Israel's lack of forthcomingness would also have a substantial impact in Israel itself, I suspect. And it would also tend to rally those forces in the Arab world and beyond who are willing to reach an accommodation with Israel, but desperately need some kind of concession on the Israeli side.
I want to get back to something you said about appointments now to the region and to policymaking on the region by Barack Obama. You mentioned Dennis Ross. Let's just talk about his appointment as special advisor for the Gulf and Southwest Asia. What does that post really ask of him? Where does that put him in this grand scheme of things?
Well, we don't really know. I mean, it's right now it's a title. It's not the title that Ross thought he was going to get 6 weeks ago. He was hoping to get, or he was putting out through the Washington Institute on Near East policy, that he would be an ambassador at large. But it's clear he will not be that. Now, it may be that he will be granted some negotiating authority, although I don't think he himself has an intention of directly engaging the Iran, but rather engaging Iran, which was the original idea. I think his plan is to use third parties initially, maybe even private parties from the U.S. government, to begin some kind of mediation or negotiation effort. But I think the other thing that was remarkable about the announcement is that it's clear he doesn't have any presidential authority. He doesn't report back to Obama. He reports only to Clinton, and his role is described as virtually exclusively advisory. Now, this lack of any responsibility to Obama is quite a contrast to the portfolios that were given to, or the lines of responsibility that were given to George Mitchell and Richard Holbrooke. And in that respect, he seems to be subordinate in the pecking order. And the fact also that his brief includes Southwest Asia runs, puts him directly in the same turf, theoretically, as Holbrooke, who's not exactly a shy person and who doesn't like other people trampling in his area. So I think the position is still very, very vague, but I don't think it's the one. The indications are that he will have less authority than people kind of attached to the so-called Israel lobby believed he would back in early January.
Well, that is interesting. AIPAC, with regard to someone else who seems to be a surprise appointment to many people, including you, Jim Loeb, Charles W. Freeman, as chair of the National Intelligence Council. Now, like Dennis Ross, this puts him in a position of reporting on intelligence and information and sort of putting this portrait together of what's going on. Does he now report to the National Intelligence Estimate Team again? Is he going to be still helping?
No, he'll be supervising the National Intelligence Estimate. So they will be essentially written under his authority, and then he will provide them to the Director of National Intelligence, Dennis Blair. I believe Freeman's appointment results in two things, both of which are unrelated to his politics in the Middle East, with which I happen to have a lot of sympathy. I think they relate to he's extremely intelligent and extremely knowledgeable in that his career has taken him to every region of the world. And he is known for independence, perhaps like no other senior Foreign Service officer, or for that matter, even intelligence officer in the whole national security world. He is a stickler for independence. And the third thing I would say is that he is known for his China expertise as well as his Middle East expertise. And I suspect that's one of the reasons that Blair recruited him. Blair was head of the Pacific Command and undoubtedly knows Freeman through his common interest in China. Freeman, remarkably, was the principal translator for Richard Nixon when he went to China on his first trip, and he was later the effective head of the U.S. interest section in Beijing before a normalization.
Just put in context the December 2007 NIE report on Iran's nuclear program. What was the significance of that report? I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but did it prevent more militant U.S. policy toward Iran?
Yeah, the National Intelligence Estimate for December 2007, which is still very, very controversial, effectively stopped the hawks in their tracks, at least those forces within and outside the administration that were hoping they could persuade Bush to mount a military attack on, at the very least, Iran's nuclear installations before he left office. Because the estimate said, among other things, that one key component of any nuclear weapons program that Iran may be trying to put together had been dropped as of 2003. Now, the media kind of covered it as saying their nuclear weapons program had stopped altogether or had been completely suspended, which wasn't exactly true if you believe that they are trying to produce nuclear weapons or at least have the capability of producing nuclear weapons. It was one of three key aspects of any nuclear weapons program, that is, the development of a warhead that could deliver it. It was that aspect that, as far as U.S. intelligence could determine, had been dropped. The importance of the position that Freeman will hold is that it stands at the apex of all of the intelligence agencies, 16 or 17 now, it might have gone up to 17, I'm not sure. It tries to provide the consensus view of all of those agencies on key issues that face the United States in the medium to long term.
And let's talk about Elliot Abrams. I know you've written that he will now be the official mouthpiece of Bibi Netanyahu.
And well, official was used not in a strictly literal sense.
So shall we enlighten listeners as to just who first Elliot Abrams is and the importance of his position, basically challenging Barack Obama's policies and coming across loud and clear as supporting Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's new prime minister now?
He was interviewed by his sister-in-law in Israel about a week and a half ago or so. That was his first kind of public foray since the administration of George W. Bush ended. And he's been very, very, very quiet and low profile. I mean, he never talked on the record to the media, and what leaks he provided to the media, I think, were very few and far between. While he was serving in the National Security Council, I mean, you know, he'd been burned by his prominence during the Iran-Contra affair when he was Assistant Secretary for Inter-American Affairs, and for which he had to plead guilty to misleading Congress, when was subsequently pardoned. Under the Bush administration, he's been much, much more quiet. So it was kind of striking to suddenly see him give an interview to his sister-in-law in Israel about 10 days ago. And since then, he's written a couple of articles for the Weekly Standard. And he has secured a post at the Council on Foreign Relations, where he will be a senior fellow, or he is already now. I think this was probably his first or second week there. And he's indicated that he's actually going to be talking quite a bit about his experience and what he thinks. And in the latest edition of the Weekly Standard, he kind of laid out what he thought about the possibilities for peace between Israel and Palestine. And the entire drift of the argument, which was about 3,000 words, not inconsiderable amount, just echoed what Netanyahu's been saying for the past couple of years to a T. And that's why I said it looks like he's going to become Netanyahu's official spokesman here in Washington.
Well, it shouldn't really be too surprising to those who know of Elliot Abrams' history as a spokesperson for America's right wing on many subjects, right?
Well, not entirely, because I would say that Abrams was pretty low-key during the George H.W. Bush administration also, when he was, you know, at some small think tanks, and similarly through the 90s. I mean, he did not go out of his way to attract attention. And I think it was because he had been so utterly discredited in the Iran-Contra affair, and not just the Iran-Contra affair. He'd been utterly discredited by his record of defending without cease the human rights records of his Central American clients during the 1980s under the Reagan administration, and arguably either was incredibly ignorant or lied with great abandon about the human rights conditions of those countries and who is responsible for those conditions.
You know, in 2007, historian author Gershom Gorenberg profiled Avigdor Lieberman, Israel's hard right leader. He called him the Minister for National Fears. But in a way, you know, Lieberman seems to have had one of these reporting posts to the Israeli government as of 2007. too. So, you know, it's interesting how people who do take these hard ideological positions sometimes rise in political power just gradually behind the scenes.
Yeah, although, you know, with Abrams, it's a different phenomenon. I mean, Lieberman has a mass constituency that consists mainly of Russian immigrants to Israel and their descendants. That seems to be where his electoral base is, and it's a real electoral base. I mean, it's probably 8 to 10% is the base, and he got, what, 12% of the vote, something like that. Elliot Abrams, I don't think, represents anybody. I mean, like other neoconservatives, he represents other neoconservatives, but neoconservatives are not a politically significant constituency in this country. They're significant in that they exercise substantial political power by striking strategic alliances with groups that do have mass constituencies, like the Christian right.
Jim Loeb, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure, it was a pleasure.
Jim Loeb is Washington Bureau Chief at the international news agency Interpress Service. His blog is jimloeb.com. He's best known for his coverage of U.S. foreign policy, particularly about the neoconservative influence in the Bush administration. Jim Loeb has also written for Foreign Policy in Focus, Alternet, TomPaine.com, and has been featured in BBC and ABC documentaries about the motivations for the U.S. invasion of Iraq. We turn now to Dr. Joel Covell to hear about his statement regarding his termination by Bard College. Professor Covell says this was because of his political views on Zionism and his criticism of Israel, and that it was a long time in development. I asked him to go over some of the steps leading to his termination from Bard College in New York.
When I came to Bard, it wasn't as a regular tenured professor because I was moving over from a career in medicine and psychiatry, an academic career at the Albert Einstein Medical School. So I had a series of contracts, and the latest contract is due to expire this June 30th, and the issue now, controversy, derives from the fact that the school said they will not renew my contract. So as of that moment, I will at best be Professor Emeritus, and they will not have a teaching role anymore. So that's what happened after 21 years, which, you know, it's complicated, and it's not something I can just dash off in a minute or two, but it's the essence of it, and I can defend that, is that I think it's a political decision, and I think it's based upon my highly controversial views about Zionism.
What is the significance of the Zionist movement in today's Israel? I know people may think of Zionism as a movement that is not, you know, quite powerful, but why don't you put it in context?
Zionism was a movement before the State of Israel was founded in 1948. But the State of Israel is, so to speak, the fulfillment of the ideal of the Zionist movement. So that when you talk about Israel now, you mean Zionist Israel, the Israel that came out of the Zionist struggle, which was victorious in 1948. And everything that's happened in the almost 61 years since is shaped by the reality of Zionism. This is now not so much a movement, although there certainly are Zionist organizations and the like, but it's shaped by a Zionist state, and the Zionist state realizes or attempts to realize the Zionist ideology or dream, and that's the key point, is that ideology. So the ideology of Zionism is that the destiny of the Jewish people depends upon, rests upon, there being a state in historic Palestine of, by, and for Jews, a Jewish state, a state that expresses the historical narrative and the historical role and the historical consummation of what it is to be Jewish. So that's the essence of Zionism, and to the extent that Israel is an ongoing institution, which it certainly is, you'd have to say that Zionism lives in the State of Israel. There are complications, there are different kinds of Zionists, there are people who are very hard line about it. There are people that are more soft line about it. There are people that think that Zionism should be spiritual. There are people who think that Zionism should be secular and all that. But the fundamental point is that you need a state, Israel, a state, to express the historical destiny of the Jewish people. Now, I've been very opposed to that idea, and I've written about it and spoken about it, and that has made me a target for a another side of what it is to be Zionist, namely, which is to protect the state of Israel from the kind of thinking that people like myself have, namely that Zionism is a bad idea, and I think it's a very bad idea.
I always thought of Zionism as an idea some Jews believed in.
Right.
But if you're talking about a Jewish state, and if the Zionist movement has sort of incorporated that somehow into its rhetoric about what it means to have a country, then it almost seems as if the setup is, if you're Jewish, if you support the idea of a Jewish state, therefore you support Zionism.
That's correct.
Is that the heart of your problem?
Let's say one chamber of the heart. You know, it's an essential part of the problem. And, you know, I have to back up a little bit from here, because some of this is grounded in what it means to be Jewish in any given country, and every country has its own kind of Jewishness. And the U.S. has been at the center of world Jewish experience and culture now for quite a long time. And let me make a qualification, a very important one. Zionism reports to speak about Jews in general, but Jews in general is a category that doesn't really work very well if you look at the reality, because there's no such thing as a Jew in general, except someone who advocates the Jewish religion, Judaism. But, for instance, I'm definitely Jewish, but I don't believe in the Jewish religion. So there's no real way of identifying Jews, except that this is what you call yourself in order to establish yourself as a people. Now, there's a very enormous history of the Jewish people. It goes, you know, back thousands of years, and it has fantastically interesting sides to it, and you can spend the rest of your life studying it and so on. But one thing about you learn is that there's no single way of being Jewish, and there's no singular subset of Jews that represent all the others. However, in the United States, the vast majority of the Jewish population, which comprises still the largest Jewish population in the world, came from Eastern Europe, and particularly from Russia and Ukraine, which is where my own family left from in the early years of the last century. And these are so-called Ashkenazi Jews. Basically, the word that sort of means German-type Jew. Even that's more complicated. But, you know, Polish, Ukrainian, Hungarian, well, the Slavic Jews, the Jews who spoke Yiddish and sometimes called the Yiddish nation, and so on. Now, that's the fraction of Jewish people who conquered Palestine, and the Israeli state was a state of, by and for, not just Jews in general, but Zionist Jews. And in fact, there are many significant divisions within Jews in Israel itself, particularly amongst the Jews of Asian and African origin and the Jews of European origin. So, right away, it gets a little more, complicated. But the basic problem for U.S. Jews is that Jewish people, of which I'm one, have, so to speak, achieved enormous success in the United States. But there's also been a cost to that success, which I think Jews of all kinds freely recognize, namely a loss of their traditional identity. Identity as outsiders, identity as, ghetto-dwelling people. Now, all of a sudden, over a few decades, Jews move right to the center of national experience in the United States. And there's a concurrent loss of identity and a fear that maybe, you know, you gain the world and lose your soul and all that stuff. And that fits very importantly into the Zionist picture of things, because Israel becomes the signifier, the way in which Jews who are otherwise thinking that they're going to lose their identity can say, no, no, this is us. You know, we're Jews, and we know we're Jews because we believe in Israel. And that caused a profound identity in the U.S. between the idea of Zionism and the idea of what it is to be a Jew, and is one major reason why the problem is so tremendously controversial and, you know, hard to change in the United States. Because it's not just, you know, you support a nation state for material reasons, for geostrategic reasons, for whatever, but it's a support that cuts to the very heart of who you are as a human being. That's the very problematic core of it. That's a highly problematic core. Because when I said it, Zionism is a bad idea, I mean it very literally. It's an idea that doesn't work, cannot work. It produces, shall we say, endless contradictions. And so that it's always turbulent and very conflict-ridden to be a Jew and a Zionist and a Jew in America. And this is being played out every which way, including in my life at Bard College.
Bard College might one day face the question of whether or not they should be invested in Israel if they are?
You know, I think that's a very important issue you raised, namely the question of divestment. For the first time, an American college has begun divesting itself from securities and corporations that support the state of Israel. Corporations like Caterpillar or Motorola, there's a big list of them. That's a big turning point, and it's a result of Gaza, you know, and it's a result of this shift in opinion. So you have Bard College having to, you know, also answer for its involvement in Israel. It's a little different from Bard because Bard doesn't have a very large endowment. I don't know how many securities it would have in Motorola or, you know, Caterpillar or the like. But what it does have is a board of trustees that itself finances the college. So the president goes basically every year to the board of trustees, and these are wealthy people, most of them on Wall Street, and they come up with the money to run the school for the next year. But still, divestment is a very lively issue. It's an issue that should be debated across our country and is being debated, and Bard will have to answer to that, yes.
Now, you have some information that has to do with academic freedom being threatened by this very same problem at other universities. Can you just enlighten us about the scale of this problem overall?
Well, it's hard to get the scale down pat because part of the repression is repression against investigating it too much. But there are groups that are starting to uncover this. And one is a group called Muzzle Watch, MuzzleWatch, and it's a subsidiary of Jews for Justice, a Jewish group. Then there's a group that I was one of the founders of called the Committee on Open Discussion of Zionism. That's CODZ.org. And there are others. There's a rising tide of criticism against this. There's a website called If Americans Knew. So we're getting more and more documentation of this. And it's a big battle. It's an ongoing battle. The Zionist side is fierce in its opposition. They're highly organized. They have more or less all the money they need, and they have extensive roots throughout our society. But I do believe that the people are rising up and calling attention to this. There was the loss of tenure by Norman Finkelstein at DePaul University. A young academic in North Carolina was let go because she showed films too supportive of the Palestinians. Her case, his name is Terry Ginsburg, her case is going through adjudication. Even as we speak, there are many, many instances of this sort. And, of course, more to the point is the kind of soft repression. In other words, so-and-so publishes an article critical of Israel. Next thing you know, so-and-so is not promoted. There are several cases at Columbia University of this sort. Professor Al-Haq, who is an archaeologist, wrote a book, rather apolitical, about controversies surrounding the archaeology of Israel, where everything is contested because they want to believe this was originally a Jewish state, which really wasn't. And she went through holy hell to get her tenure. There's a very, very militant Palestinian scholar named Joseph Massad, also at Columbia. And he is still embroiled in this and is having endless trouble getting his tenure. It is a very ongoing and active process.
You can read the statement of Professor Joel Covell, K-O-V-E-L, regarding his termination by Bard College online at joelcovell.org. And we'll be hearing more from him again in upcoming weeks as we continue to cover the Middle East. We're producing a series of one-hour specials. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.